death of the adoptive families, adoptive parents. And in fact, counsel was very accurate in suggesting that in formulating these contracts or these documents, we are talking out of both sides of our mouths. In fact, the contract that is used most commonly suggests that that's exactly what's occurring. On the one hand, we understand, the birth mother understands, and that's what the document says, that an adoption process is going to include the termination of her parental rights. On the other hand, the document says the adoptive family have agreed to be obligated by the following terms and conditions, and then it sets forth the anticipated visitation, continued contact, whatever that might be. In fact, those agreements are not enforceable. I have two sources of information on that. One is the appellate courts, including one case from the Supreme Court of the State of Oregon, one from the Court of Appeals, both telling us that those contracts are not enforceable. Second is just simply talking to lots of trial court judges, being very interested over the last 5 years in this subject, and I've been told time after time after time by the trial court judges that in the event the judge believed that the visits, the contact, was disruptive to the adoptive family, then that they would not enforce them.
That's in the absence of legislation.
And that's in the absence of legislation.
Which is not to say that the legislature couldn't make them enforceable.
Absolutely not. And this is what this bill would seek to do. Let me tell you that despite the fact that I've spent a significant amount of my time, certainly almost all my volunteer time, supporting open adoptions, I don't like the legislation. And the reason I don't like the legislation is that at first blush, it's a great idea to have those agreements that you're entering into enforceable. It's something that we deal with all the time as lawyers. On the other hand, out of the hundreds of these that I've done, and remember, only say 30% of my practice is in the adoption area, these adoption agreements, despite the fact that both the birth mother and the adoptive family are informed that they're not enforceable, are almost always honored. And in fact, out of the work that we've done, I can come up with just three examples out of hundreds where the adoptive family has refused or failed to honor the adoption agreement. Now, when I compare that to the notes that I prepare for clients, the real estate contracts I prepare for clients, there's a significant difference. After having said that, what I like about it is the tension that's created. If you sit down and tell a birth mother that sign up on this document, you've got a right, you can get these visits, they don't have a choice, that's the way it's going to be, you get one result. If, on the other hand, you sit down and tell a birth mother that if the visits are going to work, it's going to be because you've built a relationship with the adoptive family that works. If they're going to work and they're going to continue a long time, it's because you've been able to build a relationship. The individual visits are if not enjoyable, certainly somewhat satisfying to the adoptive family. What appears to have happened is the birth mothers have taken that to heart. And so the effect of it has been, I believe, that the birth mothers feel very compelled to make those visits satisfying, to make them non-disruptive, to make the adoptive family more comfortable rather than less comfortable with them. And it seems to have had a good effect rather than an ill effect. So it's a combination of the experience on the one hand of seeing them almost always honored, and on the other hand, liking the tension that's created once you tell them it's your responsibility to go out and make this work.
So that you don't have the birth mother coming in saying, I don't care if you had vacation plans. Our agreement says that on the fourth Friday of the year, I get to visit the child. This is the fourth Friday of the year. Where's the child?
Exactly.
Well, let me ask this, John. You've been doing these for half a dozen years now, open adoptions. Do you think your experience about, you said that they're almost always honored. Do you think your experience will change if you were sitting here 20 years from now, as a 48-year-old lawyer? Hello. As a 20 years from now, do you think that you'll be looking back on your experience saying, well, they work and they're honored for the first 5 or 6 years. But after that, the visits just get to be kind of a hassle, and by and large, the adoptive families stop honoring the agreements.
To the extent that the visits are a hassle, it seems like it might be best for all parties to suspend the visits anyway. Secondly, what I'm finding in my practice is it's the parents, the adoptive parents of the children who are 10, 11, 12, 13, and 14 years old that are the most comfortable with visits and, in fact, are wanting to establish visits when they otherwise aren't available. And the reason for that is that the kid's driving them nuts. The kid's got lots of problems, as so many kids do, and this is one that they can perhaps deal with. The theory behind them is that if they can spend some time with the birth parents, it doesn't take them long to understand that they really were loved at the time of the pregnancy, they really were loved at the time of birth, and the fact that they're not with that family today is in no way an indication that they've been rejected as human beings. Oftentimes, adopting a child out under those circumstances is an expression of love, an expression of capable love. It's hard for a 14-year-old to understand that, unless he's got some contact with his birth mother, can see that in her eyes, and I told you I could sing the praises for a long time, and I won't get into that any further than that, but that's the source of it.
Okay, we've got some questions. Council and then Representative Sanceri.
Representative Sanceri goes first.
Representative Sanceri and then Council.
I think that we have a tendency to have warm, fuzzy thoughts about these kinds of things rather than see all of the reality of it, and I'm sure you've seen both sides of it. As many as you've done, I've been involved in about 30 of these only. And I have a concern that where the adoptive parents and the natural parents, or the birth mother only, may make an agreement, they've never met before, usually, may make an agreement and the adoptive parents are willing to begin to allow some kind of visitation, that it may prove to be a detriment to the child to have that natural mother. I mean, maybe she's a druggie and she's just not going to kick the habit.
Absolutely.
And she's creating problems, and it's to the best interest of the child to terminate this. And most of the adoptions I've been involved in have been terrific and turned out wonderful. Some of them have not, and part of this is the reason is that when they got started allowing the visitations, it really became a serious problem to the point where finally the natural mother was undermining the relationship between the adoptive parents and the child. And I personally would have a real problem supporting this bill if there's not some mechanism to create a termination. It provides for the right to visit, but it doesn't provide for a termination if that's necessary. And I think that I'd like to see that. I don't know what your comments would be on that.
The other circumstance where they have met, and she's not a druggie at the time of the birth or shortly thereafter, but is 3 years later. Absolutely. I feel so strongly that the adoptive family should have the confidence that they're controlling the program. That's their responsibility as parents, and they should have that responsibility. They should have that power. And the last thing I would want as an adoptive family to have found that the deal turned bad for whatever reason and have to every 6 months deal with that sort of tension, that sort of unhappiness.
So you'd support a termination, some termination language in there?
Let me tell you, yes. Let me tell you, there's kind of a problem with that, because I have down at line 22, I have some language written in involving the best interests of the child. I've also represented a lot of birth mothers. More than half of my work is, in fact, with birth mothers, not adoptive families. And one of the things that you find is that in any contested matter between the birth mother and the adoptive family, in front of a judge, the prejudice against the birth mother and in favor of the adoptive family is absolutely enormous. It is almost impossible to do anything with it. And if you were, for example, to put in a language to the fact that if you don't put any language in there qualifying the circumstances under which these will be enforced, it's my guess that the court will say, well, that must mean if it's in the best interest of the child. If that language is in there by judicial fiat or by the legislature, then what's going to happen is the birth mothers are going to lose every time anyway. They're going to come in, they're going to testify about all the horrible things. The child wasn't sleeping 3 days before or 6 weeks afterwards. They're disruptive, they're unhappy, they're driving us nuts. And I think time after time after time, a domestic relations judge is going to say no anyway. So I think that if there were language limiting it, as there almost has to be, or the court will do it on its own, that it's not going to work out that way anyway. I just don't think it's going to work.
Right. Ms. Peterson, can you give us your views, please?
Representative Clark, members of the committee, Mr. Shelley has given a very good explanation of all the pros and cons of the open adoption agreements. Our position is a neutral position on this bill. There are many reasons in favor of open adoption agreements and also concerns about them. We have one concern about this bill, and that is on line 20 and 21, where the court could order that the birth parent become the future guardian of the child if the adoptive parents are unable to continue custody. And we think that while that may be appropriate, that there should always be a court hearing to review that, and that perhaps rather than the custody automatically reverting to the birth parent, that extended members of the child's family be evaluated and that the court give a review of that.
Okay, questions? For any of the instances? Line
20 and 21.
Page 1, line 20 and 21.
Page 1.
Representative Clark, can
right.
I bring up two more
sure.
points real quickly? And that's on the flip side. The first one at line seven and eight, unless the decree contains any of the provisions listed in ORS 109-350. Without that language, what this statute does is it provides for clarity in the relationship between the adoptive parents and the birth parents, and the child. It provides basically that regardless of any mistakes which the lawyers or the court may have made in putting together the adoption, after a year has passed, the only basis upon which to set aside an adoption is to show that the birth mother was, that even if there were fraud and duress, that after a year, the adoption is going to be supported. The adoption is not going to be set aside. And it's my understanding that the reason that that statute was placed there was simply so that the adoptive family at one point could have absolute confidence, even if we did make a mistake someplace along the line, that we're not going to have to go back, and we know that this child is ours, the child can take confidence in that, we can take confidence in that, and go along with life. The difficulty here is that for some reason, and I don't understand why they'd want to do this in this particular legislation, people who had open adoption agreements would not have that protection, and I simply cannot understand why that protection shouldn't be available to every adoptive family. That's the first point. The second point is down at line 36, with respect to inheritance from the birth family. I guess I don't understand that. It doesn't make a whole lot of difference on the one hand, but it seems like that should be taken care of by way of wills rather than by legislation anyway.
All right. Let's try something, committee. Let's move into work session on House Bill 2673. For the purpose of the chair moving an amendment that would delete the entire contents of House Bill 2673 and insert in its stead language that says, no person shall charge, accept, pay, or offer to charge, accept or pay a fee for relinquishing a minor child for adoption. And to that motion, if members of the committee feel very strongly
the whole bill.
That the open adoption language needs to stay in there, then perhaps I could be convinced to withdraw the first part of that motion. But I at least am convinced I'm convinced by Mr. Challey's argument that if the open adoptions are going to work, they're going to work because people have built a relationship and continue to build a relationship, not because we've got the strong arm of the state requiring that. And so the purpose of my motion, quite simply, is to gut and stuff the bill with the provision that outlaws baby selling. Now, that can either be done instead of the bill that was brought to us or as an amendment to and in addition to the bill that was brought to us. But that's the motion.
Read your motion again.
Is this outlaw surrogate motherhood?
No. It has nothing to do with surrogate motherhood. Because it talks about paying a fee for relinquishing a minor child for adoption. the act would be the payment for relinquishing the child, not for burying the child.
This also doesn't outlaw reasonable expenses post adoption.
Mr. Chairman, I don't care if it does. In fact, I was kind of hoping that it did. If I read me wrong.
Well,
I mean, I don't see if you, and how do you not relinquish the child if you've just literally given birth to it? I mean, there's got to be a moment there.
I guess the question would be, what would be the, and we can actually put language in about surrogacy if you'd like, one way or the other. But my motion is to simply outlaw baby selling through the process of adoption, not surrogacy. That's what I'm trying to get at. And if we want to visit surrogacy, we need
we
to do
are.
That separately.
We are.
We are going to visit
we
that.
We are going to visit.
We're going to visit that.
Unless Representative Bauman changes her mind.
Okay. Representative Bauman, you have a bill. You have a bill
yes,
on that. Okay.
Yes.
All right. Representative Mason, with your.
That's fine.
All right.
Doesn't go far enough.
Okay. All right. So the language again would be: no person shall charge, accept, or pay, or offer to charge, accept, or pay a fee for relinquishing a minor child for adoption. And that language is right out of Senate Bill 134.
No, that's not. That's an inaccurate statement. With all due respect, that's actually out of current law, and
right.
It's rewritten.
Okay. Like I said.
The CSD introduced Senate Bill 134, so I didn't want them, you know. I could see the hackles
no,
go.
No, the first
the
part
sentences.
About the no person shall charge, accept, or pay, or offer to charge, accept, or pay a fee for is out of existing law relating to locating a minor child for adoption.
Locating.
Then I've added the phrase relinquishing a minor child for adoption.
So a person could receive a fee for doing that then? Or is that specifically prohibited? Receiving a fee for locating a child.
That's current law.
Current law does.
That's current law. That's current law. All we're proposing is to gut and stuff 2673 with language that outlaws baby selling through adoptions. Now, counsel, one question for you or for Ms. Peterson from CSD. Would it be wise to insert a provision asking CSD to adopt some rules defining what expenses are inside and what expenses are outside of that provision? Would that be a wise addition?
Representative
I have another
Clark.
Amendment too, Mr. Chair, when you're free to
yes, talk. I think so. The current statutes don't authorize CSD to write administrative rules, and there is a lot of confusion.
Okay. John, what's your thinking on that? Because there is obviously some gray area as to what would be payment for relinquishing the child. And I mean, arguably, one could say that I don't know what the difference is between medical expenses and reasonable living expenses, and when does that become unreasonable living expenses, and so on and so forth.
Can I comment on that?
Sure.
Because that really is where a lot of time is spent. I mentioned earlier that the working definition that I've always used, it came through Fred Stock, who used to work for Children's Services Division. I don't know where it lives over there at CSD. Was that it is appropriate to pay for expenses reasonably related to the birth or to the pregnancy, birth, and recovery of the birth mother. The questions come in when you find, for example, a birth mother who is unable to work because of the pregnancy, and all of a sudden, instead of having that $1,200 a month job, she needs to have some help, say to the tune of $600-$800 a month, so that she can make it through financially to the end of her pregnancy, to the point where she can once work again. In looking at those, I find that those are, I personally don't find that those are exploitive. I don't find that even though it can include a significant amount of money, that adoptive families find those payments to be generally exploitive.
I think that CSD is the right place to come up with some rules specifying that.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Parks.
I like yours. It's simple, and leaving CSD out, if we use the what the phraseology that you just said, that rather than making it an administrative process, to just
okay.
use what are reasonable expenses. And I'd
okay, then Representative Parks moves a conceptual amendment.
As to just what he said, I think
John, what was
simple.
That language again?
That it's appropriate to pay expenses reasonably related to the birth, pregnancy, and recovery of the birth mother. The only thing I would add to that is the adoption process itself, so that they could pay the attorney's fees of the birth mother and those sorts of things.
We will take that as We will take that as a conceptual amendment. Council will draft some language for us. We'll bring the bill back to us to look at the final language next time we visit it, which will probably be 10 days or 2 weeks. Further discussion on that conceptual amendment. Representative Parks.
We got to have something that happens to you when you don't obey this, whether it be a fine or a misdemeanor or what.
Well, that's a good
and
point.
We could talk about that next time. But
okay.
We
have okay. Let's discuss the proposed amendment now about adding a little bit of definition to what it means to. We got to back up. The chair has a motion on the floor. First of all. Representative Parks, before I take your motion, we need to vote on my main motion to gut the bill and stick the language in about no person shall charge except.
One question about your proposal, and that is, what about the minister who does this kind of counseling and has been receiving something for connecting parents with an attorney and creating a private adoption?
But he doesn't do it.
Yeah, I think that probably comes outside the pale of what we're talking about.
Well, but actually, I think that's regulated by current law.
Because of the fee for locating?
Yes.
So that may be illegal under current law.
That's my first reaction. That's their first reaction.
All right, then let me do this. Let me take Representative Park's motion as a friendly amendment to my main motion, so that we would be pulling the existing language out of House Bill 2673. We would be inserting instead the language, no person shall charge, comma, accept or pay or offer to charge, comma, accept or pay a fee for relinquishing a minor child for adoption, period. And the conceptual language that Representative Parks moved about expenses reasonably related to the pregnancy, birth, and recovery of the birth mother. That would be my motion. Further discussion on that motion. Is there objection to that motion? Okay, it is adopted then, and we have a gut-and-stuffed bill. Now, Representative Sunseri, did you want to raise a concern, or did you already?
I think I raised it.
Okay, we're going to bring the bill
but
back.
I'm not satisfied with the answer.
Okay, well, we're going to bring the bill back with the language that Council's going to draft up for us, so you'll get another shot at this. Okay, anything further on this bill?
Yes.
Representative Mason.
I have a conceptual amendment, and I'm was trying to write it here. I'll take a shot at it.
Father Mason.
Yes, in the amendment reads something to the effect of, in administering any of its adoption programs, the Children's Services Division shall not show any preference toward, and I might add another phrase, nor prejudice against any adoptee or potential adoptive family based upon race, creed, or national origin. And I think they know what I'm talking about.
Okay. First of all, to your motion.
Yes. There have been numerous instances that have been brought to my attention where children have been adoptive families waiting for children, and CSD has not placed them because the adoptive parents were not the right race. I disagree with that position, and the amendment's aimed directly at that policy. If CSD wants to defend itself, feel free to go ahead.
Okay, Representative Mason, I actually received an inquiry from a constituent about that policy, and I think, Liz, isn't it true we sent a letter to CSD and asked them what their position was? We got a nice letter back explaining the position, and all that's in a file somewhere. Representative Carter? Okay. Either one of the folks from CSD, can you comment on the proposed amendment for us?
Representative Mason, CSD's policy is to seek to place children with relatives first, members of their extended family, and if that's not possible, then to seek to place them in an adoptive home of their same race or same culture. And if that's not possible, then we seek to place them in an appropriate adoptive home.
Okay. So would you read the proposed amendment as ending your current practice of looking to place a child with its same race or culture first? I would.
You would read it that way?
I would read it as ending that practice.
Yeah.
Well, let me, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Mason, I assume that you intended to end that practice.
Yes, and let me tell you what, and they can admit it or they can deny it. It's been my understanding that there have been instances where there were families waiting for children but you have held up the possible adoption because they were not the right race. That you, essentially, there were children remaining in foster care because you couldn't find a family of the right race. That's exactly what I'm aiming at.
Representative Mason, I'm not aware of any cases like that. We have had some difficulty in finding homes for children of color, but we have not had other families waiting for those children.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Sateri.
I have a letter that I just received from a constituent who is a foster care child in my district, and they are white folks and they're caring for a black child. Have had the child about a year and a half and wanted to adopt the child. They were told specifically that they really weren't the right race to adopt the child and that there needs to be competition here before we let you just take this child and adopt it. And they've had the child for a year and a half, mm-hmm. and it created some real emotional roller coaster for these parents.
Yeah.
So the situation exists. I
appreciate the comment. Let's do this. There's a motion on the table. Republicans are supposed to be in caucus 10 minutes ago. Let's vote on Representative Mason's motion and bring that back on the language, ask Council to work with Representative Mason on the specific language. Also, that'll give CSD folks a chance to go back, regroup, and come back with some formal comments about that proposal. So, and you wanted to say something about that?
Representative Clark, would that also include opposition to the national law and state law, Indian Child Welfare Act, because that is also part of your concern.
My understanding is that we don't have a choice. We would be preempted by federal law on that, whether
we don't have a
not,
choice on that.
Whether we liked it or not.
Wouldn't apply to Indian babies.
Okay.
Okay, then further discussion of Representative Mason's proposed conceptual amendment. Is there opposition to the proposed conceptual amendment? Hearing none, it is adopted. We will ask Council to work on the language there for both of those issues. We'll bring the bill back in about 10 days. Anything further to come in front of us on House Bill 2673? Anything further to come in front of the subcommittee? We will be in recess until 6 p.m. tonight. And
some of us.
Yeah, and I realize I'm not going to have some members. What we need for a quorum to work tonight basically is the Republicans and tag team Democrats, because I know you guys are in caucus.
I'm not going to caucus. I'm going to go down the hall and
you'll be coming and going. Representative Maddox will be coming and going. I know you've got to go to caucus. I don't remember. All right. We'll be at recess until 6 o'clock. Meeting of the Family Justice Subcommittee. We will open as a subcommittee of the subcommittee until we get a quorum here. We'll begin with public hearing on House Bill 3051. Ask Judge Harrell to come up. And while he is getting himself squared away, counsel, would you remind us what this bill is, what it does, and where we left it when we left our heroes?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3051 would prohibit the civil compromise of certain misdemeanor offenses. What a civil compromise is, for Representative Sinceri's benefit, since he may not know, is that if the victim of a crime agrees to have the charges dismissed in return for what would be a civil remedy, then that can occur. So rather than bringing criminal charges, a victim is allowed to bring a civil action or receive civil damages, actually. But what this would do is prohibit it in situations of, I think, domestic violence.
Thank you, counsel.
Great.
My pleasure.
Thank you, counsel. Judge, thank you for being here, and we will look forward to your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Stephen Harrell. I'm a circuit court judge, Multnomah County, and I serve on the Domestic Violence Steering Committee in Multnomah County, which is one of the sponsors of this bill, or at least one of the requesters, of the bill. Mr. Chairman, I think this may be the most important single thing that the legislature can do this session to combat domestic violence. As Ms. Robinson said, it adds a new section to 135.703, which is the section which limits the use of civil compromise in Oregon and makes it unavailable in domestic violence cases. And I just handed some proposed amendments, which I think are probably okay, that were apparently submitted at the time of the last hearing. Well, one of the things that I think I might be able to help the committee with here tonight is the criminal justice side of this. Civil compromise is a method for resolving certain kinds of wrongful conduct outside the criminal justice system. And it only applies by statute to misdemeanors. And instead of punitive sanctions, it authorizes the court to proceed, or the court would authorize the parties to proceed civilly and make restitution to the victim, in which case the case is dismissed. And it's a good device, and it makes good sense. But what it's designed for is property crimes primarily. In other words, theft, vandalism, criminal mischief, that kind of thing. And even works sometimes, I suppose, although I haven't seen it happen very much, in some personal injury cases where the offender pays medical bills or wage loss or something like that to their victim. But the key to civil compromise is restitution, and that's what I really want to talk about in the context of domestic violence. This does not work in domestic violence cases, and it works